From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I don't want to kill any of my characters. And so then it makes it very hard for them to send me any script, because there's so many movies where all the characters get killed all the time here in the US. I don't know why you're so obsessed with killing on film. Why are you so obsessed with that?
Hollywood chased after Swedish director Ruben Östlund after his well-received 2014 film Force Majeure. But Östlund, whose new movie The Square is rolling into theaters, isn't so sure he wants to be caught. The Swedish filmmaker tells KCRW's Matt Holzman how he went from making ski movies to sharp social satires. He also explains why he ended up casting Elizabeth Moss in The Square, even though he originally wanted a Scandinavian actress for the part. But first on the News Banter, we talk about box office, but only a little. First and foremost, more sexual misconduct fallout. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my co-conspirator in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi, I've never been called a co-conspirator before.
Yes, but we're going to conspire right now to produce The Banter. Once again, you know, this is not ending, this ongoing unmasking of sexual predators or alleged sexual predators in this industry and others now. And the two biggest names that have come up in the past week or so that we haven't had a chance to talk about are Kevin Spacey and Brett Ratner. And both of these are alleged to have assaulted various people, and you can read about that. But what's also notable is both of these are very connected with The Business in terms of, for example, Kevin Spacey, they were shooting the sixth season of House of Cards, Netflix was. At first, they were going to go ahead, and a few minutes later, they said, we're suspending this. You know, millions of dollars on the line there. And I suspect that they cannot restart this with Kevin Spacey because, as we've seen, oftentimes these allegations are tip of iceberg and other things come out. I think Netflix may have some suspicions in that regard, as well as MRC, the company that produces the show. And Brett Ratner, you know, he is part of a fund that co-finances the Warner Brothers film slate. Now, that deal is winding down. He's been in a lot of major Warner Brothers films with that. He was first in partnership with Steven Mnuchin, who is now Treasury Secretary, then Jamie Packer, who is an Australian billionaire who took off after not doing very well in that partnership. And now he's got this Len Blavatnik, who is a friend of Trump and has all sorts of interesting connections to Russia, whatever, but money, very rich. And so, you know, Warner Brothers is just going to have to do without that deal. And Brett Ratner has had to vacate his very plush offices on the Warner Brothers lot after allegations involving him.
Yeah, and I think this is probably going to spread. I mean, I don't know what CBS is going to do with Jeremy Piven, because some of those allegations have been made against him, and he has a very high-profile new show on CBS. It really does come down to how far this scandal is going to spread and who is going to be impacted by it, because I think the business implications of this are going to be widespread.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to be extremely responsible about what we investigate and how we investigate it. But as we've said before, there are nervous people, and some of those nervous people run companies in this town, significant companies. And if these things pan out and turn out to be well-founded, these allegations that are coming to us and we are getting deluged at The Hollywood Reporter, then, you know, we can't ignore allegations because somebody is rich and powerful. We're going to pursue. And if we can get it on the record or confirmable, then we're going to go forward. And this could really be a big shakeup in this industry, as you said.
Yeah, you actually did a really great roundtable this past week with some high-level industry women talking about the issue of harassment. And the most interesting thing to me about that was their ideas for solutions and ways to get past this and to use this scandal to effect real change. And I think first and foremost, the idea of having more women in positions of power and prominence within the industry is a good one and is something that will impact the culture at these companies. But there is this issue of accountability, and how this was allowed to fester for so long was this notion of no one thinking they would be caught. And coming to some kind of an industry-wide framework for setting up ways to report this kind of behavior and real consequences for it, I think, are crucial.
Yeah, you know, there's no doubt that the culture itself is part of what keeps women out of these jobs. I remember years ago, the late Dawn Steele, who was one of the very few women and who had gotten to a point of running a studio, she said to me once, if I could go whoring with these guys, it would make my life so much easier because so much was done and honestly still is done when people take, you know, little trips to Las Vegas or to Europe or to, you know, wherever. And really, there is like a wink and it's guys. The women are not included. And this was pervasive and still, I think, continues to exist at certain major companies in this town. And women are just simply cut out. It's a version of the deals being done on the golf course, except in this case, the deals are done or the bonds are formed in activities of the boys having fun that women can't be a part of.
Yeah. So the question is, who can get in there and address this? I mean, the guilds have relatively little power over this. The organizations like the Academy or the Producers Guild, all they can do really is be reactive. Kathy Kennedy, the Lucasfilm head and Star Wars producer, said in a speech that she wants to come up with some kind of an industry-wide framework for this, where there are procedures where this behavior could be reported, you know, maybe even outside the context of that person's particular company.
Well, obviously, HR has not helped any of these people. It didn't help people at Amazon. It didn't help people at the Weinstein Company. And I promise you, there are other companies where HR has not helped. So HR, you know, as many employment lawyers have said, is there to protect the company more so than the alleged victim. So chances are you're going to be settled out or somehow made to depart if you bring these to HR. So people have said that when they brought some of these stories to us, who was I supposed to tell? And that is hopefully the question that Kathy Kennedy can address. So I'm just going to be, you know, shock the world here, Matt, and go to a subject other than sexual harassment for the first time in a while, which is Disney and Star Wars. The Last Jedi is coming into theaters mid-December. Disney is driving a really tough bargain.
Yeah, there was an interesting Wall Street Journal piece this week saying that the price of admission for theaters, the amount that they will have to split with Disney, Disney's going to get 65% of the receipts for Last Jedi, which is far over the typical 50-50 split. And with some penalties, it could go up to 70%. And this is interesting to me because, first of all, it shows just how powerful Disney and the Star Wars franchise is to the movie theaters, because in a down year for movies, all of these theaters are praying that Star Wars can get here soon enough to save them. And it's really not going over well with the theater owners.
Yeah, it's a particularly problematic thing for small towns. You know, there is a guy in, I think, Iowa, who's told the Wall Street Journal that he's in this tiny little town. Any movie, even if everybody wants to see it, plays out in a couple of weeks. And if he's forced to keep it in theaters as long as Disney wants him to, because Disney is wanting them to stay for at least 4 weeks, he will just have Star Wars playing to empty theaters day after day after that first initial opening.
I think Disney is probably fine with that, because what they really want is for Star Wars to stay in these megaplexes in big cities where people may go back and see it 2-3 times if it's available. And they have the leverage at this point. This is a gigantic movie, almost certainly going to be the number one movie of the year. And they are the ones that are in the position of greatest bargaining power.
So this is like a tricky strategy, because Star Wars is Star Wars and Disney's doing pretty darn well. But, you know, they may have movies that need a chance to run a little longer because they aren't doing as well. We've seen some of the movies that they release fail. And, you know, the theater owners may have long memories that they had this rammed down their throats if it turns out that Disney doesn't blink.
Yeah, the relationship between studios and exhibitors is this long, tortured love affair where they
love-hate affair.
Yeah, they need each other, yet they're constantly trying to out-leverage and get more out of each other. And a couple of years ago, it was this cry from theater owners to release more big budget movies outside of the summer and holiday window. And now that's happening. And now I think the next battlefield is this notion of split in revenue, where the studios are going to start to demand more revenue in order to make up for a lot of the flops during the rest of the year. They want more out of their big hits.
And that's not even mentioning the fight over how soon the studios can release these things in other formats, which is the other gigantic battle brewing. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new film, The Square, is a darkly funny social satire that follows Christian, played by Danish actor Klaus Bang. Christian is a suave, high-minded curator of a modern art museum in Stockholm. Early in the film, he sits down for an interview with an American journalist played by Elizabeth Moss.
What are the biggest challenges in running a museum?
We're a museum of modern and contemporary art, so we need to present art that is the art of today, art that is absolutely cutting edge, and the competition is fierce.
After his wallet and phone are stolen, Christian finds that it isn't so easy to live up to his ideals as he seeks out a bit of vigilante justice. The writer and director of The Square is Ruben Östlund, a filmmaker who got on the radar in Hollywood with his 2014 movie, Force Majeure. That film won the jury prize at Cannes and made the shortlist in the Best Foreign Language category at the Oscars. Östlund returned to Cannes this year with The Square, which won the top prize, the Palme d'Or, and once again, Sweden has selected his film as its entry in the foreign language category at the Oscars. Östlund sat down with KCRW's Matt Holzman.
Some people may not have seen The Square, your latest film, or Force Majeure, your last film, but they might have seen a video of you and your producer, Eric Hemmendorf, watching the nominations of the Oscars and waiting for the category of best foreign language film, waiting for your film to be named, and then it's not.
Yeah, it's called Swedish Director Freaks Out When He Misses Out on Oscar Nomination.
Tangerines from Mauritania, Timbuktu,
Bengkvar,
and from Argentina, Wild Tales.
We're dead.
And we actually were filming, we were staying in Trump Hotel in New York, and we were on the short list, so it was 9 films going down to 5. I mean, it's more than a 50% chance. So we were kind of cocky, you know, like we will get nominated. Now, okay, let's look at the when they're announcing the nominations. And then we're not. And we got like we get so disappointed. And we didn't know what to do. So I can tell you now, it actually, that video is fake. So part of it is real. And then later that night, we were like, we have to do something with this situation. And it's so bad that we didn't get nominated. So we took inspiration from the film Force Majeure that is called Worst Man Cry Ever. And then when I'm going out of the frame, when we were filming from the photo booth camera, I'm adding like that I'm freaking out. And, you know, Eric is going, don't undress, Ruben, don't undress, and things like that. And we put it up on internet. And yeah, pretty quickly, a lot of people were looking at it and sharing it. But I had some problem with it also, you know, because some friends were calling me, are you all right? You know, is everything fine? And I have to say to them, you know, they were super sweet and engaged in if I was feeling well. And I said, no, it's fake. And then they got hurt, you know. I have invested my feelings in you and this video is only fake. So,
well, I think it's very interesting that a lot of the reaction was, man, this guy is really, he's pathetic.
Yeah.
But no one took notice of the fact that it was your company that put the video up. That should have tipped them that there was something amiss, right?
Yeah.
But that's the nature of viral videos, right? There's no critical thinking. It's like they take them on face value.
Yeah.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, that was kind of the exercise.
Definitely. And I mean, I think those people that have seen Force Majeure and know a little bit about me and Eric, at least, then, you know, we love when you show a crack in yourself or you're pathetic. When you show up those sites that you're a little bit ashamed of, you know, so...
Oh, that's what your movies are about.
Exactly.
Well, I want to get into that, but I do want to ask you a question about... Wikipedia says that you started making ski movies.
Yes, exactly. My mother comes from far north in Sweden, so we were spending the winters up there, and skiing was like the thing that you did when you were a kid there. And I got very, very interested in, you know, free skiing, like going off piste and...
Yeah.
And
by the way, I've watched some of those movies and they are hairy.
Yeah, these are the films that I was brought up with. I have never been like a cinephile. I actually brought up with these ski movies that I watched over and over and over and over again because I was so interested in skiing. And then I started to film skiing and I was spending like maybe 5 years traveling around in the Alps and in North America filming skiing in the winters and then cutting and doing ski films that were sold to other ski fanatics, basically. So that was my film school, more or less. But then I started directing school in Gothenburg also after that. And then I dropped out from skiing. I left the ski world completely. And I started to do Yeah, other films.
It's funny, you're supposed to drop out of the real world and go skiing, not drop out of the ski world and go into the...
No, exactly.
So as you started to make films after going to film school, did you play up the fact that you had done ski movies or did you play it down? Because you make movies that have such extraordinary kind of social commentary, it's hard to put together the guy who made the ski movies with the guy who makes the movies that you make today.
I know what you mean, but for me, I think that I always take the experiences that I have had earlier in my life of something that is a quality for me. And I have to use that knowledge that I have about that world because it says something also about existence in general. So I've never like tried to push it away. I'm proud of it. I'm very proud of the movies that we made, the ski films that we made. They were writing a lot about them in American Powder magazine, for an example. But I think the reason that the kind of content that I'm dealing with in my feature films and in my fiction films, I come from a family where we were constantly talking politics and society and what we should do to create a better society. So I come like from a background with a family where they were very politically aware and interested. And my mother was like a teacher and my father was a teacher. So like a mix between like this politic discussions and an academic upbringing, I think, made me do the films that I make now.
All right, well, let's get back to The Square, which has a lead character who is a very handsome man. The man who plays the curator, Klaus Bang, is maybe not familiar to a lot of Americans. He plays this role with extraordinary deftness. Can you tell me about his background and who he is?
He have mainly been in the theater, I would say, in Denmark. He's a Danish actor, and I was not familiar with him before I met him on a casting session in Copenhagen. For me, he was a new discovery, and I think also no Swedes knows about him. Not that many Danish people know about him. So
was that important?
He's a late bloomer. I was actually trying out many actors that are quite famous, also internationally, but he was just doing it in the best way.
Well, I think from my point of view, not knowing him is wonderful because he is a bit of a cipher as a person who does this art speak and is a guy who is deeply entrenched in the world of art, which has content, but also in kind of the corporate side of it. He has to move between these two worlds, so he kind of doesn't have a center. I mean, it's perfect that I don't know who he is because you can kind of see right through him in a way.
I agree. I think there's another quality also when we don't know who he is, and it's that we project ourselves on him quite much. You know, if you have a very famous actor in the main part, then you look at him with all the background that this famous actor have. And then you have to deal with the main character in a different way than I did in The Square. But in The Square, I really wanted Klaus Bang to be, how do you say, a projection surface for ourselves. So we are looking at him as a human being dealing with a setup that can be hard to handle. And then bouncing back that mirror towards ourselves and like, what would I do?
Right.
And that is maybe easier when you have an actor that is not that well known.
Well, and on the flip side, his spurned lover is Elizabeth Moss, who's an actress who's known worldwide. And she's an amazing actress, so that's one reason to cast her. But I wonder if you cast her because she was so well known or whether there was a business reason casting her because the movie would appeal to American audiences.
Actually, no. During a casting session in London, I met some international actors that I suddenly had access to because of Force Majeure had quite a good reputation here. And WME that I'm working with, they set me up with a couple of actors. So I was meeting Dominique West and Elizabeth Moss on the same day in London. And we did a quite long impro on the scene that Elizabeth and Klaus is doing in the where they have this chair installation in the background. And she was just better than anyone that I met before because I didn't want to give that part to an English-speaking actor. I wanted to stay in Scandinavia. I wanted to make a Scandinavian language movie. But both Elizabeth and Dominique were so good in playing in their parts, I had no choice, actually. Seriously, I respect Elizabeth a lot and I've seen her before. But I maybe this is a time that we can just meet up and try out if we have something in between us for another project later on. But she was so good in playing that part, so I had to give it to her.
You know, there is a scene where she's confronting Klaus for having slept with her and then disappearing. There's a number of scenes like this where there's sound off screen in the movie. It's a very present sound. It's almost overwhelming the dialogue, but you never see what it is.
Mm.
I don't recall that I've seen that in another film, and yet it it really works because that's an experience that we all have, right? Mm. We don't have conversations in quiet sound stages. We have conversations in the real world. And I wonder how that came about. Why did you decide to have this incredible noise in the background?
Since they are in the museum and they are in one of the galleries, I was thinking maybe there's like an installation that have like sound installation piece or something like that, that is like on and repeat and just goes like over and over and over again. And then it has this super loud sound when it's crashing. And I loved the idea, you know, to let Elisabeth and Klaus that have this kind of awkward discussion about, like, now we have a social contract. We have had sex.
Right.
How do we solve this?
Right.
And Klaus is like, solve what, you know?
Do you just go have sex with just anybody?
Excuse me?
Do you just go have sex with lots of other women? Is this something that you do a lot?
Private question, isn't it?
I loved the idea of that sometimes they would be interrupted by this sound of the installation, the art installation, that makes them stop and have to wait for a long time after a very awkward question was
so just
put
making,
out.
You're making an awkward situation more awkward, which seems
exactly.
to be a specialty.
Yes.
You have. You like the awkward situation.
I think I like it, and I think a lot of humans like awkward situation because we're such a social animal. And that, you know, that awkward is one of the most Googled word on internet. There's a lot of other things that is Googled before, but awkward is quite high up on that list.
Really?
So I think we have the same relation to looking at awkward situations as we have as looking at violence. Violence, we get an adrenaline rush, a secondhand adrenaline rush,
right.
where we don't have to participate. We are scared of it, but we enjoy it because it gives us like a rush. And the same thing with awkward situations.
Right.
Since I don't like dealing with violent situations that much, I really love dealing with awkward situations because they give us that rush too.
Coming up after a short break, director Ruben Ostlund tells us why Hollywood makes him nervous. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're listening to KCRW's Matt Holzman and Swedish director Ruben Ostlund talk about Ostlund's new film, The Square. The movie, a send-up of the modern art world, stars Danish actor Claus Bang as Christian, a handsome, somewhat arrogant museum curator. After some con artists relieve him of his phone and wallet, Christian is determined to get his belongings back, no matter what it takes. And one questionable decision snowballs into several. Meanwhile, at his museum, a YouTube video meant to promote a new art installation called The Square goes viral for all the wrong reasons. Ostlund has his own experience making viral videos and admits he is fascinated by them.
Yeah, as much as you may have cinematic influences, the internet and YouTube and homemade videos somehow have a real impact on you.
Definitely. And now when we have all these video cameras in the cell phones, and people are like by accident end up in a situation that they shoot with their cell phones and put up on internet. And these clips, they are approaching the content in a different way than cinema does. Cinema is so much focused on storytelling. Mm. You know, will they get each other? What will the hero win? Etc., etc. But those clips, they are focusing on a small moment when we can highlight something about human. And that is really, really what I love.
Well, one of the most talked about scenes in The Square is very much what you're talking about, where an artist who's played by Terry Notary, this is a guy who has been in Cirque du Soleil. He's quite a physical actor, and he's in an art situation where people don't know how to behave around him. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing is it looks like a gala ball at an art museum. There's very well-dressed, generally elderly people who are there to, you know, mingle and give some money to the museum. It's a very elegant setting.
Yeah. Right, go ahead. And do you know why I dressed him in tuxedos?
Why?
Because I was aiming for Cannes in competition, and I wanted, you know, all the films in competition have a tuxedo-dressed audience, like sitting there in Lumiere, looking at another tuxedo-dressed audience.
Oh.
And then Terry Notary's character comes out and creates a little bit chaos for them.
A little bit.
Yeah. It's a voiceover coming out in the speaker system, and all these tuxedo-dressed audiences sitting
Welcome
there and listening,
the
and it goes,
Soon
you
will
be
confronted by a wild animal. As you all know, the hunting instinct is triggered by weakness. If you show fear, the animal will sense it. If you try to escape, the animal will hunt you down. But if you remain perfectly still, without moving a muscle, the animal might not notice you, and you can hide in the herd, safe in the knowledge
that someone else will be the prey. And that is really pointing out the bystander effect. You know, when we are in a public space and there's a lot of people around us and something horrifying is happening on the other side of the street to one person, to one individual, then we tend to not help. And this is a behavioristic term, bystander effect or bystander apathy, and we become paralyzed almost.
Not necessarily because we're bad, but because we assume somebody else is going to take care of it.
Yes, also. And also because we are herd animals. So I'm trying to make us reflect on our behavior from a behavioristic point of view.
Right. So that scene is an incredibly uncomfortable scene. Does anybody think that it's real?
A lot of journalists is asking me if the extras knows what Terry Notary is going to do. And we were shooting that scene for 3 days. We had 300 extras. I think we'd made around 40 takes on every single camera position. So we have repeated over and over and over and over and over again.
Oh, my God.
So, and my method is a little bit, you know, that we try out the scene in the beginning of the day or that camera position or that shot that we have for that day. And we have repeated quite many times. And then I go, no, it's 5 takes left. Come on, everybody, you know, trying to build up an intense feeling of a presence, an authentic feeling to the moment. And then it's 4 takes left, everybody, come on now. And you do a countdown. So when we are in the last take, it becomes like a super important football game. And now let's win this football game together. And I have the feeling then we can create a combination between something that is very, very well rehearsed and at the same time making it authentic.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's shown in this scene.
Has Hollywood come knocking on your door? Do they want you to make the next Star Wars movie?
They have sent quite many scripts to me. But I have had something that I want with the project. And it's like I said, I don't want to kill any of my characters.
Hmm.
So then it makes it very hard for them to send me any script because there's so many movies where all the characters get killed all the time here in the U.S. I don't know why you are so obsessed with killing on film. Why are you so obsessed with that?
On film?
Yeah, in
we're
the movies.
We're just obsessed with killing.
Ah, okay, then I get it.
The movies are just a reflection of our national character.
But I really, really think that...
Do you want to make a movie here?
I think that I want to be in control over the production and the way that we have been shooting. So, and I've been producing on my own production company in Sweden that I own together with my friend, that is Erik Hemmendorf. And it has been a very, very good way for me to have continuity. And we have been doing a film every third year. And I'm curious about a lot of things in the American film industry, but I'm also a little bit scared of it. You know, I have many friends that went here and have been trying to develop project for many, many years, and then they come back and they never made a movie. So it's putting a lot of time on something that never happens, and I'm scared of that. I'm curious, but I'm also a little scared.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. You're wise. Ruben Östlund is the writer and director of the extraordinary film The Square. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.